Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
And one of the principles that will really underlie each session that I do here is the idea that objections to the gospel don't need to be obstacles, but they can be opportunities for evangelism. Objections to the gospel don't need to be obstacles, but opportunities for evangelism. And we can use people's objections, misunderstandings, and questions as a way of getting into the gospel, both publicly, and we'll think of examples and show you an example of that, I think, tomorrow, but also personally through conversation. Sometimes we talk about evangelism and apologetics as two separate spheres. I prefer to use what John Lennox talks about, the idea of persuasive evangelism, rather than drawing this dichotomy between this intellectual approach, which doesn't get to Christ, and this evangelism that doesn't engage the mind. We need to be doing both together, and particularly that's what we're thinking about. So objections can be opportunities, not obstacles. Second principle, which underlies what we're thinking about today, is this, that Lindsay may have said this already, because it's what he says often, but in any student movement, in any church that is really wanting to make an impact evangelistically, you need three levels of evangelism. And we see this in the book of Acts. We'll see it as we go through with John in the mornings. We need public proclamation, and we will think about that through this week. You need small group interaction, discussion, and you need one-to-one evangelism as well. Often people promote one of those to the exclusion of the others. So they say, preaching doesn't work. We just need personal evangelism. That's what's going to change our country. Then other people say, personal evangelism doesn't work. We just need preaching. That's what's going to change our country. Actually, in reality, and I've seen this in student ministry in particular, it's where you have an emphasis on both, hand in hand, that you have the biggest impact. So what we're thinking about today in this session is thinking about this particularly in a personal way. How could we engage in one-to-one evangelism? And then later in the week, we'll think about doing this in a more public context as well. Particularly, we're thinking about using questions in evangelism. A Bible trivia question as we start. Can anyone think of the first question in the Bible? Where are you? Is the second question in the Bible. What's the first question? Did God really say? Yes. So those two questions, sorry, it's a slight trick question. Two questions in Genesis 3. Satan asks the first one, doesn't he? Did God really say? In fact, it's not so much a question but a sneer, isn't it? Did God really say? To which, of course, Adam should have said, yeah, now what's your question? And then God's question, where are you? Now, have you ever thought about that? You know, why does Satan ask, did God really say? Was it because he didn't know what God had said? And I think, of course, he did. Why did God ask the question, where are you? Is it because he couldn't actually find Adam and Eve and was, you know, are they behind the oak tree? I don't think it was he was playing hide and seek. Again, God knew the answer. Why do both God and Satan ask questions? Because questions have a value and a power to them. A value not just for the person asking the questions, but also for the person who is being questioned. And I think that's really significant, and I want us to think about that. If you look at the ministry of Jesus, you see that Jesus asks over 200 questions in the Gospels. Again, why does Jesus ask questions? Because he doesn't know? Well, of course he does. So always for the value of the questioned, not just the questioner. So I've jotted down in the notes, there are 10. Actually, I've added one more, so there are now 11, just to make it uneven. But there are 11 reasons why I think questions are helpful. We're going to fly through these fairly briefly because of time. And hopefully these will be helpful for us personally, but also helpful for those that we're working with in our churches, our organizations, and so on. So feel free to steal these ideas and repeat them. There's no such thing as stealing in the Christian church, just borrowing, as Lindsay knows, because I stole his talk a few weeks ago on a mission we were doing together. So the value of questions. Number one, questions start conversations, which is a pretty obvious thing to say, but it's true, isn't it? If you're going to start a conversation, it normally starts with a question. Can I sit here? What's your name? How are you? Fairly innocuous questions, but they have to start somewhere. The principle is this: not every conversation we have will get to the gospel, okay? But if you never start a conversation, it's guaranteed to not get to the gospel, is it? And so the challenge is to actually make sure we're starting conversations. It's very easy to go through life not really having conversations with people. And the more we have conversations with people, the more possibility there is that those conversations will get to the gospel. So let's not just wait for other people to start conversations with us. We can be proactive in starting conversations with them. Secondly, asking questions helps us to get to know people. It's easy, isn't it, to assume that all non-Christians fit into the same category, or to think that all non-Christians in our culture represent the views that we hear in the media. But what I'm discovering is that actually the views that we hear represented in the media are not necessarily indicative of the general view of people in society. So we need to ask questions to know where people are at. Don't assume that everyone in Britain is like Richard Dawkins, because increasingly they're not. And so if we talk to people as if they are the most angry atheist, we will not be engaging with them. So we need to get to know people, and asking questions will help us to do that. Number three, asking questions will take conversations deeper. There are three levels of conversation you can have. Someone put it this way. They said there is an exchange of words. That's the conversation that you have in Britain that starts, "Nice day today, isn't it?" "Yes, it's a lovely day, but it's going to rain tomorrow." "Yes, I know." Talking about the weather, talking about sport and so on. It's not really doing anything more than just an exchange of words. Then there's an exchange of ideas. You might talk about politics. You might talk about other things. You're actually using your brain at this point. It's a deeper level. But there's a third level of conversation, which is an exchange of emotions or feelings. It's talking about your heart, talking about your life personally. And in conversation, have you noticed, actually, you need to take a conversation. You don't start in that third level, do you? You don't walk up to someone in the street and say, "Tell me your deepest fears," because that will close people down immediately. You may start in Britain by talking about the weather, because actually, in British sociological culture, that's the way you get used to talking, and then you take it deeper. But this is important because people often talk about the gear shift in conversation, the challenge of taking a conversation from secular things to spiritual things. People say that, so maybe in your church, you know, "I can talk about secular things, but I find it really hard to change the conversation to spiritual things." But what I've realized is actually the challenge is not so much from going from the secular to the spiritual, but from going from the superficial to the significant. You see, if you only ever have superficial conversations about the weather or about the football, then to talk about Christian things will always seem a big gear shift, a big shift in the conversation, because you are going immediately to a very deep conversation. But actually, there's a way of taking a superficial conversation to a significant conversation so that then it's not such a big gear shift to talking about spiritual things. So one of my challenges I often throw out is learn to have deeper conversations about anything. It doesn't have to initially be about the gospel. Because once you're having a deep conversation about significant things, it's not then a big jump to talking about the gospel. So questions can take conversations deeper. Think about Jesus with the woman at the well. He doesn't go in and just say, "Hi, tell me about your broken relationships." He goes in and says, "Can you get me a drink of water?" And then through that conversation, he gradually intrigues her through the things that he says until he asks that question, "Go and get your husband," which then really gets into the personal detail of her past. Doesn't start there, but he gets there, and we can learn from that. Number four, questions provoke questions. I normally find it's a good principle not just to, as someone once said, vomit the gospel over people at the first opportunity, you know. Unasked, just offload as much as you know about the gospel every time you get the chance. But to wait until people ask you a question which enables you to say something about Jesus or something about your Christian faith. But the way that people often ask those questions is by us asking them questions first. If you ask someone enough questions about their life, eventually, unless they're incredibly rude and self-centered, they often ask you a question back. And then you can be wise in saying something which might provoke further questions. You don't necessarily say everything at once, but as Becky Pippert in her book says, you drop bait into the conversation, like you're fishing. You drop a bit in to see if they bite. They might ask another question off the back of it. So questions provoke questions. Just for a moment, turn in pairs now. Some of the questions that people ask are questions that we want people to ask, aren't they? You know, you're a Christian. Tell me, what is Christianity all about? It's a great question. You're a Christian. What must I do to be saved? Brilliant question. But there are other questions which we don't necessarily enjoy being asked as much. You know the kind of questions where you're thinking, well, how can I now answer this question and continue a conversation and maintain a friendship? Those kind of questions, you know? The questions that make you pray for the immediate return of Christ. Okay? So just discuss in pairs, in your country, what would those questions be? The questions that you would most fear getting asked, okay? And helpful maybe to think especially of your context. And then we'll shout some back in 2 minutes. So just take 2 minutes to do that. Okay, so what about suffering in the world? And that's a pretty universal issue, isn't it, in every culture, because suffering's there. Did anyone else come up with that one? A couple? And then when someone close to someone has died, you know, what's happened to them? Have they gone to hell? Where are they now? Anyone come up with that one? No? Okay, one. But that's quite a personal one, isn't it? Because then you're thinking, you know, particularly if you know, as far as humanly we know, that they weren't a Christian, they'd not trusted Christ, you know, how do you answer that question? Because often when a question is personalized, it becomes much harder. You know, why is there suffering in the world? That's one question. Why has my granny got cancer? Is a very different question. Well, it's the same, but it's a harder one to answer because it's suddenly personalized. In the same way, you know, what happens after death is a very general question. You know, what's happened to this person who I love who's died? It's the same question, but because it's personalized, it then suddenly in our minds becomes a much more difficult one. We could probably discuss more. That's helpful to get those things in our minds. As we continue then, bear in mind that these things will help us respond to questions. So questions can open up conversations. Those are the principles we've looked at so far. But questions will also help us as we respond to people's questions or objections. So number five, we got to. Questions will unlock people's assumptions. Questions unlock people's assumptions. You remember the story of the rich young ruler in the Bible? Comes to Jesus. Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Do you remember what Jesus' response was? Before that, what was the first? Why do you call me good? Okay. So his first response is a question. Now, if someone said to me, what must I do to inherit eternal life? I would be tempted to use that as an excuse to explain the gospel. But Jesus didn't. What was the assumption behind the rich young ruler's question? That he can earn salvation. You know, that I can be good enough for heaven. So what is Jesus doing? He's asking a question about that assumption. This man says, I can be good enough for heaven. And Jesus is saying, well, who is good enough for heaven? And actually, he goes on to say, well, only God is good. In other words, only God is good enough, and your application to join the Trinity has just been turned down. You're not. And then they have a conversation about why that's the case. And eventually, through a conversation about the law, he asks that really challenging question, okay, go and sell everything you have. And that reveals the real problem in his heart. So Jesus asks a question to unlock the assumption. I think this is important because most people have false assumptions about the gospel because they put Christianity into religion category like everything else. So if someone says to you, do you think that if I'm not a Christian, I will go to hell? And you say, yes. What will they now think about you? Bigoted, racist, judgmental, unloving, arrogant, etc. Okay? By the way, how many of those are in the fruit of the Spirit? None, okay? So if you answer the question and that is all the assumptions they've come to, they've now assumed a lot of things about you that hopefully are not true, okay? Now, why have they assumed that? Well, what do most people think, or how do most people think you get to heaven? Good works. And why would you go to hell? Because you're bad. So what they think is good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell. You're saying, I'm a Christian, I'm going to heaven. You're not a Christian, you're going to hell. So what do they hear you're saying? I'm good, you're not. And if you were going to say to them, hi, I'm a very good person and you're not, and that's why God accepts me, you can understand why they would be offended, okay? So you need to unlock the assumption that gets behind the problem. And if answering the question leads people to come to lots of wrong conclusions about the gospel or about you, it's probably because you've not unlocked that assumption behind it. So that's a really important principle. Number six, asking questions will help define terminology. This is key. People use words, but what they mean by the words are not necessarily what we mean by those words. So my favorite example of this is when I was getting my hair cut once, the lady cutting my hair discovered I was a Christian, and she said, I really admire your faith. And I thought that was kind of a compliment. And I was about to kind of say, well, do you have faith, and so on. And then I asked her the first question. I said, what do you think faith is? She looked at me in the mirror, as you do when you're in the hairdressers, and she said, faith is the ability to believe things that aren't true. And I said, do you admire my ability to believe things that aren't true? And she thought for a moment, and she said, oh. And then I said, because I think I would pity people who have that kind of ability. See, she had this assumption about faith, which I guess it's maybe an extreme version, but it's often an assumption people have, isn't it? You know, faith is believing things for which there is no evidence. It's irrational and so on. So unless I asked a question about what she meant by that, the conversation wasn't going to be helpful. If I said to her, you should have faith too, I would be commending something that I actually don't want to commend. So ask questions. What do you mean by that word? What do you understand by that concept? It will help immensely in conversation. Number seven, asking questions will help when people are antagonistic. And Tim talked about people who try and catch us out in conversation. And motive behind a question very much depends the way we answer the question. You see this with Jesus. When people ask Jesus genuine questions, wanting to know the answer, Jesus will give a straight answer. When people ask Jesus a question, wanting to catch him out, his answer is almost always a question. So I think of the two best examples, maybe in my mind. You remember when they come to Jesus and they say, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Yeah, it's a brilliant trick question, isn't it? Because if he says, yes, you should, then the Jews will hate him because he sides with the Romans. And if he says, no, you shouldn't, the Romans will kill him because he's undermined their authority. So whatever he says is wrong. It's a trick question. The problem is with the question. There is such a thing as, in logic, we call it the false dichotomy, where whatever you say is going to be wrong. You can do that in conversation every day. People used to say it in the playground when I was a child. They used to say, does your mother know you're stupid? Yes or no? Whatever you say in answer to that question, you will have to admit to being stupid, okay? Because it's a trick question. It forces you into a false dichotomy. You can say it to a married man. You say to him, yes or no, have you stopped beating your wife yet? Okay, whatever he says, he's in trouble, okay? And whatever Jesus says, yes or no, he's going to be in trouble. So he answers the question with a question. Show me a coin whose image is on it. Caesar's. Or give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. Now, interestingly, they don't ask the question they should have then asked, which was, if the coin belongs to Caesar, what belongs to God? To which I think Jesus would have said, whose image is on you? In other words, you are more important than your money, and God's more interested in you than just your money. But they didn't ask that question because they didn't actually want the answer. They just wanted to trick Jesus. And then the next question, where they say to Jesus, by what authority are you doing these things? Again, trick question. So Jesus turns it round. He says, John's baptism, was it from heaven or was it from men? And they go away and they have a conversation. And they say, if we say it was from heaven, they'll say, why didn't you believe him? If we say it was from men, they will stone us because they think John was a prophet. So they come back to Jesus and they say to Jesus, we don't know. And you remember what Jesus said? Neither will I tell you. Have you ever thought that actually that is not grammatically correct when you're responding to someone who's just said, I don't know? Okay? If someone said to you, I don't know, you would have to say to them, neither do I know. Okay? But if someone actually in their heart is saying to you, I'm not going to tell you, then of course you can say to them, neither will I tell you. So in Jesus' response, he's actually saying to them, I know you're not stupid enough to answer my question, and I'm not stupid enough to answer yours. You remember Jesus says we need to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves? Sometimes the best thing to do is not to answer the question, because the question is a trick question, and we need to read the motive. Jesus does it. Questions about homosexuality in Western Europe are often, not always, but often trick questions. And sometimes the best thing to do is not to answer it. And certainly in a public context, often I'll say, look, I cannot answer that satisfactorily in 2 minutes. I will happily talk to you in conversation later. Because whatever I say in 2 minutes will be enough to hang me, but not enough to really answer the question satisfactorily. So we really need wisdom in that. I remember talking to an atheist in Liverpool University in the northwest of England. And he was very angry and he said to me, what about all that violence in the Old Testament? How could God command people to do such violence, like in the book of Joshua? Now, there is an answer to that question, but there is not a simple answer to that question, is there? You can't answer that question in 1 minute. And so I thought, if I try and answer this question, he's immediately going to just ask another one. He's not really wanting the answer. So I said, well, look, can I ask you a question? He said, okay. So I said to him, what would you do about ISIS? He said, what do you mean? I said, can you tell me what your solution is to the problem of ISIS in Iraq and Syria? How should we solve the problem? He said, I have no idea. I said, come on. Yeah, we've got all of the wealth of the West and the military force of the West. Surely we can solve that problem, can't we? What should we do? He said, I don't know. I said, if we in the year 2017 struggle to deal with the problem of evil in the world today, maybe it's more complex 3,000 years ago than we at first think, and we need to understand the context before we try and, you know, suggest what was going on. Now, we didn't actually talk much more about that because he didn't want to know the answer, but it was a helpful way of helping him to think it through. So asking questions when people are antagonistic. Number 8, asking questions can help when people are apathetic, which is like the opposite problem, isn't it? And in some ways, it's a more difficult problem. Because if you've got an angry atheist who wants to debate, at least he wants to talk. What do you do when you have someone who just doesn't want to talk because they don't think they're interested? And I think the principle here is that not everybody, in fact, I suggest in Europe particularly, a lot of people are not initially interested in religion or Christianity. They feel, I've been there, I've done that, I'm not interested. A friend talks about the fact that in Europe we've been inoculated against the gospel. You know, when you have a vaccination as a child, you're given enough dead disease so that you never catch the living variety. And enough people in Europe have got enough dead religion that they don't want a living variety called the gospel. So it breeds apathy. So how do we bridge that? A few years ago, I was doing a mission week in Denmark, and I was speaking on the resurrection on the last night of the mission. I went round the room at the end. I went to a table of students, and I said to them, what did you think of the talk? And this girl very honestly looked at me in the face and just said, I'm really not into this stuff. I'm not interested in this Christianity business. I only came because my friend invited me. So what do you do with that? Because I've just preached the resurrection. I thought, surely off that, there'll be something to get her interested. So I asked her the question, what are you interested in then? And she said, well, I'm interested in love. I think that's the most important thing. So I said to her, well, what do you think love is? And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, can you define love? And she said, well, love, it's, I don't know, was her response. So then I said to her, can I give you a definition of love? And she said, okay, sure. So I said, I'm assuming you're not a Christian. She said, no. I'm assuming you don't believe in God. No. So I said, okay, here's a definition of love. Love is a chemical reaction that's evolved in our brains to make us attracted to people, normally of the opposite sex, so that we reproduce and pass on our DNA. And she looked at me in some amount of shock, and possibly because her boyfriend was sitting next to her, she said, that is not love. And I said to her, why? And again, she thought for a few moments and she said, I have no idea. But there must be more to love than that. And then she said, what do you think love is then? And then we did have a very interesting conversation, which did get to the Christian faith. Because I said, actually, it starts with the heart of who God is and how God has made us. You see, she didn't think she was interested in Christianity because she couldn't see the connection between the resurrection of Christ and what she cared about. And so what we needed to do was start with what she cared about and then do two things. Number one, show that her worldview didn't have a sufficient explanation for why that was important. Francis Schaeffer used to call this taking the roof off someone's position, exposing their worldview for what it is, insufficient. And then number two, show that the gospel has a greater explanation for why what they think is important really is important, and takes it even further. Okay? So asking questions when people are apathetic. Don't start with what we are interested in, start with what they are interested in, and then draw the bridge to the gospel. Now, you need to think what that's going to look like in different contexts. That was a very obvious context. In some, you maybe need to think harder and work harder. I think, give you one other example. I was on a train from Romania going to Hungary, and it was going to be about 12 hours. So I had a lot of time to chat with the guy next to me. He asked me who I was and what I did, and I told him that I was a Christian, and you got that look on his face immediately that said, oh no, I'm stuck next to a Christian for 12 hours. And he wasn't interested at all. So then we got chatting about other things. Eventually we then talked about him and his life, and I asked him what he did, and he said, I'm a student, so I'm studying environmental science. My next question normally when someone tells me what they study is to ask them why. I said, what motivated you to study that? He said, well, I think we should care for the environment. I said, why? He said, because we should. I said, but why? He said, well, because we should. I said, no, but why do you think we should? He said, well, everyone knows we should. I said, well, clearly not everyone, because you wouldn't need to study it if everyone did. He said, but we should. I said, okay, so why do you think that you're right and the people that don't care for the environment are wrong? He said, because I am. I said, but that's not a very strong argument if you want to try and convince them. He said, don't you think you should care for the environment? I said, yes, I do, but not everyone does. So then he said, why do you think we should care for the environment? And then we again had a very interesting conversation about why we should. Does this world belong to us? What is our relationship to the world? And actually, as a Christian, that this world is given to us to look after, not given to us to abuse and so on. And actually, the gospel gives us the best worldview for understanding our relationship to the environment and so on. So when people are apathetic, don't start with what we're interested in. Start with where they're at. But we need to think hard. What's that going to look like in our context? What are the things that people care about? How can we build those bridges in conversation? Number nine, we're nearly through. Asking questions direct our conversations. Asking questions directs our conversations. People talk about asking leading questions, okay? But actually, every question is a leading question, isn't it? Because every question will lead your conversation somewhere. And so we need to think, what are the questions that we're asking, and where will those questions lead? And some questions will lead us helpfully towards the gospel, towards Christianity. Some questions will actually lead us away from it. I find it incredibly frustrating sometimes when I do a mission week. You give a talk about a topic, and then at the end of the conversation, a student turns to their friend and says, what class have you got next? And I say, no, that's not the question to ask now. You want to ask a question that builds on what they've heard and takes it further. And in a conversation, again, we need to think, you know, what would be the next question that I could ask that might take this deeper, that might lead this further? Again, we don't force the conversation, and we don't vomit the gospel over people, and we don't have to say everything about the gospel in one conversation. But we can be wise in seeking to lead by the Spirit those conversations and then take those opportunities to get as far as we can. Now, it might be that in some conversations we get to explain everything and we get to the heart of the gospel. It might be in some conversations we get so far and we build an opportunity and a platform that we can continue on another day. The context will define that. But questions do lead a conversation. Every question, in a sense, is a leading question. Number 10, asking questions gets to the heart. We said that there are three levels of conversation. Ultimately, our aim is to get to the heart. There's a danger sometimes with those who love apologetics to only get to the exchange of ideas. We stay on the level of the intellect alone, and we don't get down to those heart issues. I find a helpful question to ask in conversation, not immediately, but after some time, or even after several conversations if it's with a friend, is, if I could show you Christianity was true and answer all your questions satisfactorily, would you become a Christian? Or would you commit your life to following Christ? If the answer to that is yes, my response would be, great, what's your next question? A lot of the time, the answer to that question, if they're being honest, is no. To which my next question would be, okay, what is it that really stops you? And often what comes up now is not an intellectual objection, but it's a heart one. You've now got to a deeper level. You can't do it straight away, but you want to get there. And sometimes you'll find that the heart issue is not the evidence for the Gospels or the problem of evolution, but it is the experience of church I had as a child, or you know, this person that was meant to be a Christian who did this, or whatever. And you need to get to that level, but sometimes you need to earn trust and confidence through having those other conversations first that people will feel able to open up in that way. But it's amazing sometimes. You'll go from a very antagonistic, argumentative atheist to someone who can be in tears once you get to that heart level. That's what we need to do. And then number 11, lastly, questions can lead people to commitment to Christ. I find, again, a helpful question to ask is simply to say to someone, what is stopping you from putting your trust in Christ? Again, it's not the first question you'd ask someone, but when you get to a point where you think this person has understood something of the gospel, I've explained something of Christ's death and resurrection and so on, what's actually stopping you from doing something about it? John Chapman, the late Australian evangelist, had a a phrase where he said, when the fruit is ripe, any old fool can knock it off. By other words, sometimes the fruit needs a nudge. It's not that we force people into the kingdom, but we ask that question that just says, okay, where are you at? And sometimes you find that people have what they think are insurmountable obstacles to becoming Christians that aren't. I said to someone recently, what's stopping you from becoming a Christian? They said, I've not read the whole Bible yet. I said, if that was a qualification to becoming a Christian, half our church would have to leave because they haven't. It's good to read the Bible, but you don't have to read it all. And people come up with these things. You know, I've still got questions. I've got some doubts. And so on. They don't need to have all of those things sorted before they can make a step of commitment to Christ. Now, there may be some things that they do need to get sorted. Real issues that they need to overcome. And we need wisdom to discern the difference. But sometimes just asking a question can help. And I find, particularly where we're doing evangelistic courses, something like Alpha Christianity Explored, people can sit in courses for weeks and weeks and weeks. In fact, they can come and do course after course after course. But often it's when you sit down one-to-one, out of the group context, but personally over a coffee, and say to someone, okay, where are you at and what's stopping you? That's where you can see people making those commitments to Christ. And again, in a mission context, you can preach, you know, from the front. But again, we need that personal work where you sit side by side with someone, where are you at with this? And again, just that very simple question can be the thing that can precipitate a commitment to Christ in that way.